The following presentation was recorded before a live audience during the 2013 Health and Wellness Seminar held in Bay Roberts, Newfoundland. Our presenter was Dr. Tim Riesenberger, and the title of this second presentation was How to Reverse Heart Disease. It is our hope that you will be informed, encouraged, and inspired as you listen to this presentation.
Tonight we're going to be talking about what is very important to me as a physician, and that is heart disease. And the reason why it's important to me as a physician is that it is the number one killer now, not just for industrialized countries, but just recently I reviewed some literature called the Global Burden of Disease. I don't know if any of you are aware of that study, but that is the largest epidemiological study that's ever been done. It was done in 50 countries with 500 researchers involved. The researchers that were ahead of the in charge of it or were my very own University of Washington researchers, where I'm from in Seattle, where I live. And so they have actually come up recently that even the third world nations who used to die of malaria and TB, that was their number one cause of death, now worldwide, if you take in everyone into account, it is number one. Heart disease has become number one. So it's becoming an even greater concern, not just in the industrialized nations, but in the developing nations. And the problem is that oftentimes you get no warning. Diabetes, for example, yes, also has no warnings, but diabetes itself probably won't kill you. The complications from it were what usually kill you, but heart disease will kill you. You block off an artery, you'll die. So it's very serious, and we've found that a half of all sudden heart attacks have no prior diagnosis of heart disease. So in other words, your first and last symptom may be sudden death. In Canada, this is recent literature. Like I said, this is from the Global Burden of Disease, and it just came out in 2013. Is it for Canada? Of course, the number one is heart disease, but you see some other things there. What I thought was interesting is that from 1990 to 2010, over 20 years, this actually jumped 300% in Canada. Now, some people might say, well, it's because we're living longer and so more people are going to get Alzheimer's disease, but I found that very intriguing. Your car accidents were previously here. They were previously number four, so they actually went down. So you guys are either driving safer or somehow people are a little bit more careful on the road, or maybe there's less people on the road. I don't know. But there's a lot of interesting things there. What I found more intriguing with the study was they listed the top 10 causes of death in Canada as well as the causes of disease. So in other words, they listed the reasons that you die, but they also listed the contributing factors for which you die. And you see what number one is? Diet. But not just number one, but if you look at these 10 causes, how many of them are lifestyle related? I'd say probably all of them, yeah. I think that these are changeable. These are lifestyle habits. And we can have good habits. We can also have bad habits. So I think there's room for improvement. The good news is that there is a little improvement. The rate of heart disease is decreasing in industrialized nations, especially North America and Canada. And anyone have any thoughts as to why that is? In fact, cancer is going to take over as the number one cause of death in both my country and your country very soon. Any thoughts? Well, it could be the Western diet, but see, that would make heart disease go up. I'm saying that heart disease is going down, but cancer is going up. And I'll give you an example. Who knows what cholesterol is? Well, so everybody knows. Who knows what saturated fat is? Everybody knows. Who knows what LDL is? Everyone again. Who knows what HDL is? Diastolic and systolic. What does that refer to? Well, a little bit less. Who knows what a CEA 125 antigen is? Yeah. Well, that's the reason I believe that heart disease is decreasing is because there's a lot more education. We have educated the public as far as the markers for disease, for coronary artery disease. We've educated the public to what these things are, right? This is actually a cancer marker, which I wouldn't expect you to know unless you were a nurse or a health professional, probably wouldn't even know if you knew that. But that's the thing, is that if you go to the emergency department or the hospital, all those professionals are trained to zero in on heart disease, right? How do you go to the front of the line in the ER? You complain of chest pain, right? You just tell them you're having chest pain, and then everyone just flocks around you, and they get an EKG, and they draw your blood, they put you on the monitor, they put you on oxygen, they give you an aspirin, right? They're really going to move fast because they know that that chest pain may indicate a heart attack that is imminent. So they don't want to wait around for you to drop over, right? So even professionally, there's been a lot of education. Even in the business world, does anyone know why margarine was created? Any thoughts? Well, what's it designed to replace? Yeah, and what is butter? What is it made of? What kind of fat? It's pure saturated fat. So margarine is an attempt to replace the saturated fat with an unsaturated fat, like a plant oil. So the diagnosis for heart disease is sometimes very difficult because people often will present atypically. And what I mean by that is not everyone's going to say, well, doc, I have crushing left-sided substernal chest pain that goes to my arm and my jaw. I have nausea, shortness of breath. I'm sweating. And it's worse when I walk around. It's better when I rest. I mean, very few patients come in to the ER and tell that to me. Many times they say, a little heartburn, but it ends up being a heart attack. Or they'll say, my stomach's bothering me, but it's not really their stomach. It's the inferior wall of their heart that's actually referring pain there. Many times they'll complain of it being acid reflux. And they said, I took some antacids and it went away. So it's not my heart, right? Wrong. I have actually reviewed the literature, and there are people who say, doc, it hurts just like my chest pain when you push on it there. 4% of heart attacks have that. Scary. Because a lot of things that we, even as professionals, try to reassure ourselves with and say, listen, I gave them some Maalox or some antacid, or, you know, the pain went away. Heart attacks do that too. Well, I pushed on their chest and they said it was exact same pain. Heart attacks do that too. Especially when you consider three groups of people: the elderly, women, and diabetics. All three of those groups present atypically. They may have shoulder pain. They may have back pain. Remember, you were actually telling me about a case, right, Pastor Jason? You were telling me about someone who complained of just shoulder pain and back pain. What was the first thing I told you? Heart attack. I was worried about heart attack because she was a young woman, right? I believe that case was a woman and not old. She was 50s or 40s or something like that. I actually had a real case, and this was when I was a medical student. When I was training at Loma Linda University, I had a woman who was in her 30s, mother of three, had come to the hospital for something really unrelated. And we were worried about her heart. And she said, but I have no chest pain. I feel fine. I want to leave. Don't keep me on these monitors anymore. I'm tired of this. And she actually tore out her IV and walked out of the hospital three times. And the last time I was there, I ran down the hall. I convinced her. I pleaded with her to stay because she was my patient. I was rounding on her every day. She finally consented. And they did a cardiac cath or an angiogram on her. She had critical stenosis, 99% blockage in three different arteries. In her 30s. Now that's scary. And she was so convinced that it wasn't her heart that she was walking out three different times. Had she walked out that third time, she never would have returned. I'm convinced. And her children, you know, would have had no mother. They were small kids. They weren't large. They were, I think one was a teenager and the other two were, you know, in middle school and elementary school. So this is very serious. The testing that we use to risk stratify people for coronary artery disease, for heart disease, is not perfect. In fact, when they put you on that treadmill, right? Have any of you had a stress test before? when they put you on that treadmill and you run around and they do the electrocardiogram until you either complain of chest pain or you get short of breath or your legs wear out or something wears out, right? That is not always accurate. In fact, the literature shows that that can miss up to 35% of significant coronary artery disease. And the reason for that is that many times people may have a significant blockage. Like, let's say this is one of your coronary arteries. Many times you may have just a little bit of plaque or cholesterol, you know, just kind of on the side of the wall. Anyone know, by the way, when this starts? When can I actually see the plaque? Like, if I were to take a look at your aorta or your coronary arteries, at what age do you think I would start seeing this stuff deposit? What do you think? Any guesses? Yes, absolutely. In early 20s, it's visible. Now, not in all societies. It's interesting. They did autopsies from the Korean War, and they found that our GIs from North America had visible plaques, but the Koreans did not. They were all the same age. Now, what could that be? Quite possibly, right? We eat a lot more animal products, right? In North America, we eat a lot more saturated fat. We eat a lot more cholesterol, definitely, than they do. But when you get this buildup of plaque, even if you get 70% stenosis or blockage, this degree of blockage can be asymptomatic. Did you know that? No symptoms whatsoever. Not even picked up on the stress test sometimes. Now that is scary. But sometimes we do more than just the stress test. Have any of you had an angiogram before? Anyone had an angiogram? A few people have had an angiogram. So when you have an angiogram, they take a catheter which has a camera, and they actually look. Did you know that? They use radioactive dye and x-rays to look and actually see the plaque that's built up in your arteries. And let's say you have like, oh, maybe 50%, 40% blockage. This is something they don't do anything about. Did you know that? If it's less than a certain amount, they don't touch it. They don't put a stent in. They don't do angioplasty. They don't send you for bypass. However, did you know that this plaque can rupture? It can break. And when it breaks, you have things called platelets. And they start to stick to this exposed area, and they can block the whole opening within a matter of minutes. That's why angiogram is not always reliable. You may have a plaque that's only 50%, but at any time, that plaque can become unstable, it can rupture, and cause an immediate heart attack. Now, they're trying to do other forms of testing. Maybe some of you are aware of CT. They do CT angio for coronary arteries now, and they also do ultrasound. They're trying to figure out which of these plaques are more unstable. They're finding the ones that contain calcium are actually more unstable, but that's still in the mix right now. There's no perfect test for coronary artery disease. There's no perfect test for heart disease. So I think what we need to focus in on is reducing our risk. That's really what we need to do. The problem is that even some of those numbers are off. In my country, normal cholesterol is less than 200. Did you know that? In your country, it's what, 5.2? Is that right? Normal. Did you know that normal is abnormal? Because if you are satisfied with having a normal cholesterol, are you going to be satisfied with dying the normal way that everyone else dies? Because the majority of people in both the U.S. and Canada die of coronary artery disease. They die of heart attacks. And the normal is based on population averages. Does that make sense? We get a normal level with people who have no symptoms. They have no heart attack symptoms or anything like that. So we just figure that's normal. However, if you look at the Framingham studies, that's the big classic series of studies on coronary artery disease that was done over a period of 50, 60, 70 years. If you look at the Framingham studies, there was not a person with a cholesterol less than 140, or in your measurement, it's 3.6 millimoles. There wasn't somebody who had a cholesterol less than 140 that actually had a heart attack during the 50 years of the study. So in other words, that is what they have now chosen as the optimal level of cholesterol. So for you, I don't want you to be normal. I want you to be optimal. I want you to not have less risk. I want you to have no risk. That's what I'd like for you to have, because that's a true insurance policy. That's better than any sort of insurance or healthcare coverage you could get, is taking care of your health so you don't have to deal with the disease. Anyone know what the risk factors for coronary artery disease are? There's actually four. We're going to add a fifth very soon. What are the risk factors? Anyone know? We've talked about some of them already. High cholesterol. But that's related to diet. High cholesterol is one. High blood pressure. Obesity is coming. It's not quite there yet. What else? High blood pressure, high cholesterol. Smoking, absolutely. Lack of exercise is not there yet, but it's the next one coming up. So sedentary lifestyle. Anyone know what the last one is? We talked about it, actually. We talked about it yesterday. Diabetes is the big one, completes the big four. So the big four risk factors are elevated cholesterol, high blood pressure, smoking, and diabetes. Those are the big, big, major risk factors for having a heart attack. The next one that's coming is sedentary lifestyle, and then after that, probably obesity. If you quit smoking in 5 years, you will reduce your risk of heart attack by up to 70%. If you reverse your diabetes, like we talked about yesterday, you have cut your risk from 10 times to 1/10. That's huge, huge, huge reduction. The neat thing is, with blood pressure as well as LDL cholesterol, it's the same. If you look at the LDL cholesterol and also the diastolic blood pressure, if you reduce this by 1 millimeter of mercury, one milligram per deciliter, I'm sorry, that's not your units, but that's an easier way for me to express. If you reduce this by 1 point, both of these equal a 2 to 3% risk reduction for heart disease, or MI, or myocardial infarction. So in other words, if you drop your blood pressure 10 points, that reduces your risk by almost a third. Does that make sense? So lowering your blood pressure, lowering your cholesterol, doing the right things as far as lifestyle, cutting the salt, drinking more water, being more active, quitting the smoking, reversing the diabetes, all those things are going to help. The interesting thing is, if you are greater than 20% overweight and you go back to a normal weight, you lose fat, you know, for what, and in whatever way you do, they have found that your risk goes down significantly. It goes down almost 30 to 55%. There's something else, though, with cholesterol. Not all cholesterol is bad. Did you know that? There's one kind of cholesterol that is positive. Anyone know? HDL, that's right. In fact, if your HDL is 1.6 or greater, you can take away one risk factor because it's protective. And in my country, it's 60. Yours is, I think, 1.6. However, if it's less than 35 or less than 0.9, that's bad. If you have a low HDL, that's harmful, because the HDL actually is the transport molecule to remove the cholesterol from your artery walls and get rid of it. So you want that to be higher. You want that to be greater. And in fact, they've done some studies on this, and they theorize that a lot of the reasons why women have heart disease later than men is because they have higher HDLs in general. Also, the influence of their hormones also seems to help them. But that's still debatable. And, you know, if you ask someone, do I take hormones, do I not? It's still up in the air. For right now, it's no, don't. And I tend to agree with that as well. Here's some questions for you. True or false? Don't you need to eat some cholesterol? Yes. Chicken and fish are healthy. Okay. 1 to 2 drinks a day is heart protective. Fat is bad for you. Avocados are bad because they are high in fat. Nuts are worse because they're higher in fat. Coconuts are the worst because of the high saturated fat. Margarine is good for you. It's interesting. I think you guys got most of those right. Right. To give you the quick answer on all these, they are all false. They're all false. It's like the trick question, you know, they're all wrong. So as far as cholesterol, do you need to eat some cholesterol? I kind of phrased it. I didn't say you didn't need cholesterol at all. I said, do you need to eat some? Did you notice that? It's a little bit different. What if you don't eat any cholesterol? What will happen? You'll be healthy. Why? Because your body will make it. Did you know that? Your body produces its own cholesterol. You don't need to eat any of it. So the ideal amount of cholesterol in a diet is what? Zero. You don't have to eat any cholesterol. Does anyone know what foods contain cholesterol? And what foods don't contain cholesterol? Let me ask a question. Nuts are high in cholesterol. True or false? But aren't they high in fat? Yes, but do they have any cholesterol? No. See, a lot of people are confused about that. And it's very simple. Plant foods, how much cholesterol do they have? Zero. And the foods that have cholesterol are very simple. If it ever had a mother, or came from something that had a mother, it has cholesterol, right? That's very simple. So any of the animal products, right? So what foods have cholesterol? Sure, meat, dairy, eggs, right? So all those things came from mothers or they had a mother. Right, so anything that's of animal origin contains cholesterol. And the problem with cholesterol is when you eat it, it's different than if your body makes it. And I'll explain to you why that is. When you have Homo sapiens, right, that's us. Did you know we're the only species that continues to drink milk after we're weaned? And in fact, we drink another species' milk. It's true. It's true. Isn't that funny? I find that actually, as a scientist, I find that funny. I think that's very rare. That's very odd. But the thing is there ever a time when we are designed to consume cholesterol in the dietary form? Yes, actually there is. Have you ever thought of breast milk? Did you know it's high in cholesterol? It's actually high in fat too. It's got both. But what's the difference between breast milk and the other forms of cholesterol that we consume? Have you thought about that? Here's what happens. Yes, it's well, breast milk is not oxidized. Have you ever heard of that? Oxidized cholesterol, have you ever heard of that? The problem is that when they feed animals large amounts of fat, even saturated fat, even bad fats, they actually don't develop coronary artery disease. Do you know that? Until you add one thing. Oxidized cholesterol. Not just cholesterol. It's got to be oxidized cholesterol. And what is oxidized cholesterol? It means cholesterol that's been exposed to heat, light and oxygen enough to alter its chemical structure. Right? You've heard of oxidation, reduction. Those are all electron sort of terms. Those are organic chemistry terms. But the bottom line is when you are having breast milk, it's not exposed to cooking, heating, light, oxygen. It just goes from mom to you, right? That's non-oxidized cholesterol. Oxidized cholesterol is what's been processed. In fact, the more it's been processed, the more oxidation occurs. So if you like fry something, you heat something, you pasteurize something, if you heat it, then evaporate it, then dry it, then turn it into a powder and then reconstitute it, that's like the worst. So the highest oxidative cholesterols you can find are custard and pancake mixes, right? Because they have animal products, but they've been highly processed. Does that make sense? So those are those contain the highest amounts of oxidative cholesterol. So now you're all going to go out and just suck it off the cow, right? No, don't do that. You run into other problems too when you do that, right? Like disease and stuff like that. So they've found that you don't need to eat any cholesterol at all. Your body will produce more than enough. Chicken and fish are not necessarily healthy, but I will be honest with you that they don't raise your cholesterol as much as like red meat, right? So if you look at chicken and fish, do they still have cholesterol? Sure they do. Do they have saturated fat? Well, the chicken does, fish a little bit less. There's a little bit more polys, and some people would argue there's some omega-3s in fish. Have you heard of omega-3 fatty acids? Those are good for you. But did you know that you can get them in flax? And also you can get them in seaweed? I don't know if you guys can get seaweed in Newfoundland. I imagine you've got it all around you, so I imagine you probably could get it, right? So you don't have to eat chicken and fish to get the benefits, right? I will tell you that if someone eats, like let's say somebody eats nothing except for cold water fish, are they going to have a lower cholesterol than the person who eats like Big Macs every day? Well, yes. Yes. But ideally what's best is to eat the plant food diet, because you know that fish has got a lot of heavy metals in it now, right? Do you know how much tuna they're recommending for pregnant women now? How much? Why? It's full of mercury, right? And what are they afraid will happen from the mercury? It will affect who? The baby. So if mercury and tuna and these heavy metals are not good for you when you're young, why are they somehow good for you when you're older? Right? That makes no sense to me as a scientist. Like, people say, listen, when you're pregnant, don't do what? Don't drink. Why? Because it's going to affect your child. But somehow when you're older, then it's good for you? You know what? That doesn't make sense to me as a scientist, right? If it affects you negatively in your early years, my guess is it affects you, maybe not as much, but it still affects you negatively in your later years. So I don't recommend that. When you go to the alcohol question, the 1 to 2 drinks a day came from the French studies. Did you know that? The French, they looked at the French and they found that they had a lot less heart disease than other people groups. Now, once they came out with that study, what industry do you suppose got behind that study and made sure it was in every cardiologist's hand, every primary doctor's hand? Yes, of course. You get a little wine, it's good for you, right? I mean, that's a multi-million dollar industry. The alcohol industry is a juggernaut industry. It's massive amounts of money. Like, have you ever been to a theme park? Like Disneyland, Disney World, Busch Gardens. Do you know who made Busch Gardens? Anheuser-Busch. Right? That's their money. They have massive amounts of money. So they made sure that all of us as physicians got a hold of that study. However, there was a study that went on after that that showed that, yes, it's true that wine and stuff like that, it will raise your HDL, right? And what is this? What kind of cholesterol? It's good cholesterol. So wine in moderation will raise your HDL. But the later study showed it will raise all the rest of your cholesterol too. Right, that's not helpful. Did you know other things will raise your HDL too? Did you know chlorinated pesticides will raise your HDL? But no one's going to advocate that you drink some chlorinated pesticides, right? Just because your body is responding to a toxin doesn't necessarily make it good for you. And then they did further studies on the French, and they tried to repeat the study with just alcohol, which is what? Ethanol, right? And the ethanol by itself did nothing for you. It did not help you. It didn't even help your heart risk at all. However, they found there were two compounds in the red and the white wine, resveratrol and quercetin. Have you ever heard of these? Really? Good. And these two compounds were actually the active ingredients that conferred the cardioprotective effects in the wine study. But did you know where these compounds are found? In the grapes. That's right. So why not get the benefit without the ethanol? Have some grapes, right? Take your Gewürztraminers and your Pinots and juice them or eat them, right? Because these are where the compounds are. But do you think that these studies were made available to anyone? Yeah, there's no money in saying that now, right? So this misconception of the 1 to 2 drinks a day is still out there. However, I will hand it to some organizations. They're being academically honest. Has anyone ever heard of Mayo, the Mayo Health Clinics? They actually put out a Mayo Health letter now. And the latest issues of the Mayo Health letter now say they do not recommend any alcohol for people 50 years old or younger. But they also don't say that if you're older 50 that you should drink it. They said they're not sure. Right? But they have come out and committed themselves to showing that the literature is clear that if you're 50 year old or less, this is not going to help you to drink 1 or 2 day drinks. They recommend zero. And the neat thing is that the World Health Organization has never recommended alcohol. They have never recommended alcohol. That's never been a part of their stand. So alcohol is not good for you. Resveratrol and quercetin is very good for you. But those are found in red and white grapes. So definitely have the grapes. Definitely have the grape juice. If you understand, Concord grapes are the basis for most grape juice. You understand that, right? Those are not Pinots and Gewürztraminer. Concord grapes don't have the same amount of resveratrol or quercetin. These are actually wine-making grapes. These are found in wine-making grapes, and they vary in terms of concentration. I'm going to talk about those two compounds a little bit more in our longevity lecture, so you're welcome to come to that. How about fat? Is fat bad for you? There are fats that heal, and there are fats that kill, right? It depends on the types of fat. And avocado, is avocado bad for you because it's high in fat? Well, but, you know, I thought too much fat is bad for you. Avocado's loaded with fat. But what kind of fat is it? Anyone know what kind of fat is in avocado? It's a plant-based fat, but what kind of fat is it? It's mono, that's right. How did you know? Very good. It's a monounsaturated fat. And they've actually shown that monounsaturated fats like avocado and olive, they actually slightly raise your HDL. Did you know that? Avocados are very good for you. In fact, avocados are the highest concentration of potassium. Did you know that they have about 4 times the potassium as a banana? And a lot of us think that potassium found in banana. But avocado, if you eat a large avocado, the amount of potassium you are giving to your heart, because that's one of the minerals that's very important for heart health, potassium, also magnesium, but potassium from an avocado is the maximum prescription strength potassium that we would give you in the ER. Like if we gave you K-Dur or K-Chlor or K-Fizzy. There's lots of different forms of potassium, right? We give 40 milliequivalents at a time, right? Did you know 40 milliequivalents is an avocado? So whip up some guacamole, you know? Time to have some celebrating, right? So avocados are great for you. The other thing is that a large avocado has almost 15 grams of fiber. It has 13 grams of fiber. Now, is fiber good for you? It is, but we're going to show you how good for you in just a minute. How about nuts? Nuts bad for you? Good for you? It's kind of nut, maybe moderation. Well, I'm going to show you the definition of moderation on the next slide. How about coconuts? Good for you, bad for you? But they have saturated fat. But saturated fat, aren't those bad for, isn't it bad to eat saturated fat, right? Right? Well, the saturated fat, the reason why saturated fat is traditionally been viewed as so bad for you is because saturated fat is actually the number one predictor of your cholesterol. Did you know that? For those of you who are health professionals, you can look up the Keyes equation, K-E-Y-S, but you don't have to necessarily. But it's an equation that looks at your diet, the amount of saturated, polyunsaturated, and actually dietary cholesterol you consume, and it can predict to a great degree of accuracy what your level will be when we draw your serum, just based on the amount of saturated fat, polyunsaturated fat, and dietary cholesterol you eat every day. It's very easy to predict. And what they've found is when you consume saturated fat, that it actually causes your liver to crank out cholesterol like there is no tomorrow. Except when you look at the fats in coconut, it is a shorter chain fatty acid, and the liver does not process it the same. In fact, it's a little complicated process, but the reason why saturated fat has to create a lot of cholesterol is because it's not soluble. It's very hard for it to dissolve in the blood and be transported. It has to be transported by chylomicrons, and that's produced in the liver, and it's a long process. But basically, it causes the liver to manufacture more saturated fat, whereas coconut fats are short enough that they don't have to provoke chylomicron formation. In fact, the saturated fats in coconut have been recently examined. Anyone know what they're looking at it for now? Yes, Alzheimer's. How did you know that? Yeah, so what they find, I'm going to summarize the literature, and it's not much literature right now. There's not enough to say, yeah, eat coconuts for Alzheimer's. It's not strong enough literature yet, but here's their theory. Is it your neurons or your brain cells, right? Your neurons become insulin resistant also. All cells in your body live off what? Glucose, right? They all live off glucose, including your brain cells. Did you know that? And what they found is that as people age and as they get affected by bad diet, they gain weight, things like that. Also, they found that heavy metals are now implicated. So don't cook with iron, don't cook with aluminum, things like that, because what happens is those heavy metals are leached into your food and then you eat them. Because when they look at the plaques that form in Alzheimer's, they contain those heavy metals. So their theory is okay, the aluminum was out, but now it's back in, and they thought it was safe, and now it's back. It's basically not good for you anymore. So aluminum, cast iron, things like that, heavy metals are bad. Someone asked me, they said, well, what's the best metal to cook in? You know what it is? Titanium. Because titanium has a very, very, very high melting point, so none of it comes out in your food, no matter if you're like crank the stove all the way up to 10. It's never going to, titanium is never, like not one molecule of it's not going to come out. And so that's what they say. But glass is better too. So that's not certainly something that's within most of our budgets. I have titanium cookware, but it's like $5,000 for a set, so probably not everybody can get that. But it is better. It is better for you. But what they found is with these nerve cells, they become resistant to insulin. So if you're resistant to insulin, what can't come in the cell? Sugar, that's right. So if you have an insulin-resistant cell, it's going to starve, right? Because it can't get the glucose in. It needs the glucose to function. And so these cells degenerate because they're insulin resistant. However, there is some evidence, again, preliminary evidence, to show that they can absorb medium chain fatty acids and use those medium chain fatty acids to survive. If they're not getting any blood sugar, they can actually burn some of the medium chain fatty acids and continue their metabolism. And what's that? Coconut. Yeah. So there's an interesting body of literature that's just come out where they're trying to use coconut to treat a lot of these patients who have Alzheimer's. And at least anecdotally, they're getting some good results. It's not like awakenings or something like that. It's not like they're normal the next day after they ate a coconut. But over time, they do get better. So certainly keep your eyes peeled for that. Margarine is good for you. True or false? Well, it's better than eating saturated fat for your heart. But the problem with it is, how do they create margarine? Does anyone know? Margarine is a plant fat, right? And what do they do to make the plant fat act like the saturated? Because a plant fat at room temperature is what? Liquid, right? A saturated fat at room temperature is solid, right? So how do you make the plant fat solid at room temperature? Anyone know? You hydrogenate it, right? And so when you hydrogenate it, what's the problem with that? It makes it work like saturated fat, but you also produce something else. Someone said it over here. You produce trans fats. That's correct. We're going to talk about that in the next slide, but I'm going to talk about the P to S ratio of fats, the poly to saturated ratio. If you look at animal fats, what kind of fats are animal fats? They're saturated. And they're the ones that are very bad for producing cholesterol. Plant fats are mostly what? What kind of fat? They're polys, actually. They're mostly polys. Some of them are monos, but most of them are polys. And the polyunsaturated fats will actually lower your LDL. In fact, to give you a striking representation of this, they did a study with walnuts, English walnuts, black walnuts. Black walnuts actually are a little bit more active for this. But they did the walnut study, and it was done at my university, at my alma mater at Loma Linda. And what they did is they put people on walnuts, but they wanted to create a placebo control. They didn't want you to know that you're eating walnuts, because then you might think, oh, I'm eating walnuts, it's so good for me. Or, oh, I'm eating walnuts, it's so bad for me. So they wanted to avoid the placebo effect, so they ground them up very fine and put them in different foods where you wouldn't detect them. For 4 weeks, they ate not just some walnuts, but how many walnuts? A cup and a half a day of walnuts, which is 84 grams. That's like a massive amount. And in 4 weeks, the LDL cholesterol dropped an average of 18 points or 0.5. That may not seem like very much to you, but remember, for every point you drop that LDL, what happens to your coronary risk? It goes down 2 to 3%. So do you realize what 18 points means? 18 points means up to a 54% reduction in your risk for heart disease. And what does that mean? Well, this is like quitting smoking. This is like exercising when you didn't exercise. This is like achieving ideal weight. That's huge. With just walnuts for how long? 4 weeks. Not a long study. But they're doing more studies on this since the walnut study. And they find that when people eat nuts of any kind more than 3 times a week, they significantly drop their risk of heart attack. And it's not just walnuts. They are finding that the nuts that are high in vitamin E also help. Anyone know a nut that's high in vitamin E? Almonds, very high in vitamin E. In fact, also selenium is playing a role. Anyone know what nut is high in selenium? You only have to eat 2 of these nuts to get your full day's supply of selenium. Brazil nuts. Did you know that? You eat your 2 Brazil nuts, you get enough selenium just in those 2 nuts. Obviously, you can eat more if you want, but two will give you the daily supply. Also, we talked about the omega-3s, and I would recommend taking that from flax and seaweed instead of the cold water fish. And we were actually having a discussion about fish, right? And it says, well, what if you catch it wild? If you catch a fish in a certain body of water, how do you know that fish lived in that body of water? In fact, they probably weren't from that body of water. You know why? Fish's migration patterns are up to 5,000 miles long. Did you know that? If you catch a fish someplace, it may or may not have grown up there. Maybe. Maybe not. It may have lived in the sewer for most of its life. You know, you don't. It may have lived outside of Fukushima, the active waste, right, in Japan, and then it made its way over to you, and then you caught it, right? You don't know that. I don't know that either. So what we find is the omega-3s from flax and seaweed, they allow you to survive longer if you've had a heart attack. If anyone had a stent, anyone had a stent placed, if you have a stent, the omega-3s will prevent that stent from blocking off again. So that's good news. It'll also lower your blood pressure, lower your triglycerides, and prevent your platelets from sticking so much, which is the danger when you have a plaque rupture. If your platelets are really sticky, you're gone. So omega-3s are very positive, but I recommend them from flax and seaweed. So we'll get to the trans fats now. And here's how the trans fats came onto the radar. They were finding that these trans fats were so harmful for you that they banned them in fast food. Did you know that? They first banned them in New York, and now they're like illegal. Like there's very strict rules about trans fats now. And here's what happens. If you work at, let's say, a fast food restaurant, they have the deep fat fryers, right? The deep fat fryers are supposed to be changed every day. The oil should be changed every day. But they're not always changed every day. Now, the problem is when you have these plant oils, if they are not refined, are actually positive for you. Like if you eat an avocado, the plant oils in that are good for you. If you eat an olive, the monounsaturates are very good for you. But when you refine the oil is when you start to get into trouble. And they find that trans fat formation and also oxidation of the fats is encouraged by three things: heat, light, and oxygen. Has anyone ever watched a deep fat fryer in action? What three things are going gangbusters in that deep fat fryer? Heat, light, and oxygen. So there is probably no greater source for trans fat formation than the deep fat fryer. I mean, certainly if you hydrogenate oils, that's another source of trans fat formation. And for those of you who want to know the chemistry behind it, here's what it is. A plant fat is characterized by the ene bond, or the double bond between the carbons. And if it's monounsaturated, that means the fatty acid chain has one double bond. If it's polyunsaturated, how many double bonds? More than one, right? I mean, it's not complicated, but that's how it works. In a normal formation in nature, this is the configuration of the fatty acid chain. This is called the cis formation of the carbon chain. When you add heat or light, you change the molecular structure, and that structure is now what? Trans. Right? So it's a subtle difference. It's basically, if the carbons are on the same side of the carbonyl bond, the ene bond, it's cis. If they're on opposite sides of the double bond, then it's trans. Now that seems like, well, what does that mean? Well, what it means is that these types of fats are associated with like death, basically. They're associated with increased cancer. They're also associated with increased heart disease. They did a margarine study. Now, this is not margarine like Earth Balance, you know what I'm saying? This is like the typical margarine, the partially hydrogenated soybean oil. You read that on the back, right, all the time. We're not talking about the healthy sort of margarines where they use just oil and they whip it in with air and stuff like that. You know, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the typical margarine. One study showed that the people who ate 4 teaspoons of margarine a day versus the people who ate less than margarine once a day had a significant difference in their coronary risk. In fact, it was 66% increased risk in the margarine group. And 4 teaspoons of margarine, is that a lot? No, I'd say it's just you slather it on one slice of toast. I mean, a typical serving, like 4 teaspoons, right? So we don't recommend the trans fats. We don't recommend partially hydrogenated whatever oil, right? Because that favors trans fat formation. We favor if instead you want to put some olive oil, maybe some extra virgin olive oil on your Brits. You could use some coconut oil. You could spread some coconut oil. So we don't recommend using refined oils per se, but certainly that's better than butter, and it's better than trans fats, right? It's better than margarine. So we would recommend that. In fact, I think what tastes really good is you get some extra virgin olive oil and put it with some crushed garlic. You know, make yourself some garlic bread. In fact, here's an interesting study. This study had people taking 4 pills a day, but this is actually a food item. And they found that in 8 months, okay, this is not 4 weeks, this is 8 months, it's like almost a year, all right, so it's going to take some time. Their cholesterol dropped from 7.8 to 6.1 in less than a year, about 8 months. Their LDL dropped 11%, and what does that mean? 33% drop, right, in your risk of heart disease, and their HDL went up 11%. Anyone know what this food was? How did you know? Oh, you've seen the study. Very, very good. So they ate 4 cloves of garlic a day. You know, an apple a day may keep the doctor away, but the 4 cloves of garlic will keep everybody away, right? Including the heart disease, right? So if you eat 4 cloves of garlic a day and you do it consistently for 8 months, you will drop your cholesterol. And you will raise your HDL, you will lower your LDL. But the funny thing is, I have to warn you, when they checked the serum of these people at the 4-month mark, it was actually worse. Any thoughts on why that might be? Isn't that weird? Why would it be worse? Here's why it's worse. Your arteries start off, right? If you're in a bad lifestyle, they're blocked, right? The body has to take the cholesterol from the wall and put it where first? It has to go into the serum first. It has to dissolve into the bloodstream first. And then from the bloodstream, it takes it to the liver, it takes it to the gut, it takes it outside, right? So it takes time to take it from your walls to outside of you. So don't freak out if your numbers are worse after 4 months, because they will go up. That's what the study showed. They will go up, but they will eventually go down to lower than when they started before. And that brings us to the natural way to lower your cholesterol. Not only garlic, but the main way you lower your cholesterol, anyone know how? How does your body get rid of cholesterol? Fiber, that's right. What kind of fiber, though? There's 2 types of fiber. There's soluble and insoluble. And the only significance of those terms is one dissolves in water, one does not dissolve in water, right? One's soluble, one's insoluble. And so it's the soluble fiber. We're going to talk about the insoluble fiber next lecture. Soluble fiber actually removes cholesterol from your body. And the way it does that is when you eat fat. Do you know what your body needs to produce to digest the fat? Anyone know? What does your body produce to digest fat? Like when you eat it, your body produces a hormone called cholecystokinin. And that hormone will cause something to squeeze something out. Bile. right? Your body produces bile to digest fat. And if you eat more fat, what do you think it produces more of? Bile, right? Do you know what the principal component of bile is, the molecular structure? Cholesterol. Right? And what happens is when you produce this bile, right, in response to a meal, that bile mixes with your meal, it emulsifies or digests the fat, right? You absorb the fat, and you also will reabsorb the bile unless you also eat it with soluble fiber. If you have soluble fiber in your diet, it will actually create a bond between the soluble fiber. It will bind the bile salts, and it will carry them out into the toilet and away from you into whatever, from stream or lake or whatever that's it's going to go to, and hopefully the fish won't eat it and get coronary artery disease. But that's how your body gets rid of cholesterol, is through soluble fiber. And what sorts of foods contain fiber? Does anyone know? So grains, whole grains, but actually there's only one grain that contains soluble fiber. Did anyone know? Does anyone know what grain it is? That's right, oats. That's why the Cheerio box, right, says what? Lower your cholesterol in 2 months with Cheerios, because it's oats. It's not because Cheerios does anything magical for you. It's you could eat oats. You could eat your own oatmeal and get the same results. So oats contain half insoluble and half soluble fiber. They're the only grain that has soluble fiber. What other things have soluble fiber? Anyone know? Fruits, right? Vegetables, grains, beans, nuts. Plant foods contain fiber. What foods contain no fiber? Animal products, right? So meat, how much fiber? Chicken, zero. Fish, eggs, cheese, dairy, butter, milk. No. Do you notice this is almost the opposite of the cholesterol thought process? Do you notice it's kind of similar? So cholesterol is where? Animal products. Fiber is where? Plant products. And never the twain shall pass. Did you know that? Animal products will never obtain fiber, and plant products will never have cholesterol in them. They are mutually exclusive, as we say. They're on opposite sides of the fence. So animal products have zero fiber. But they have lots of what? Cholesterol. So it's like the double whammy. You're eating cholesterol, but you don't get any soluble fiber with it. So you have the cholesterol, but you don't have any way to get rid of it. So eating soluble fiber is how your body gets rid of cholesterol. Does anyone know there's another way your body gets rid of cholesterol? Who else knows that? Does anyone know that recently they have added vitamin D to the panel for routine labs in Seattle? In Western Washington, it is now routine to get a vitamin D level. You know why? Because we're all vitamin D deficient over there. Why do you suppose? Yeah. When you have the sunlight strike your skin, what is it going to produce? Vitamin D. But did you know what the precursor molecule is that it makes the vitamin D out of? It's cholesterol. Did you know that? If you doubt, feel free to look it up. It's true. So it takes as its precursor molecule some cholesterol, and in exchange gives you the blessing of vitamin D. Isn't that cool? I think that's amazing. Very neat. And also, the nice thing is there a difference between the vitamin D you eat and the vitamin D your body makes? There is actually a difference. Did you know if you take supplemental vitamin D that you can overdose on it? How about the vitamin D that your body produces? Absolutely not. Obviously, you can get sunburned, right? And that's not good for you. But your body will actually manufacture vitamin D until it's done, until you don't need any more. And interestingly enough, what's the US RDA of vitamin D? Anyone know? What's your recommended daily amount? Well, it was 400, then they upped it to 800. What is it at now? Is it 1,000 for you guys? Well, I'm glad they're being aggressive on that. But I'm going to share something with you that's going to blow your mind. If you go out into direct sunlight and you're in your backyard and you got your fence, so you decide to go out in all your glory in your birthday suit and you expose yourself completely to the sunlight, how much vitamin D can your body manufacture, say, in an hour? Any guesses? How many international units? This was the full day supply. Then it went to this, and now you say it's, 1,000 or something? What do you suppose it can make in an hour? How did you know? It's 10,000 units an hour. Isn't that incredible? So what do you think? Do you think we only need 400 a day? Hello, right? If your body can make 10 grand an hour, that should tell you that we were designed to be outside, right? We were designed to enjoy the healing beams of the sun. Now, obviously, don't burn, right? I have a friend of mine. She is, like, not just white, but as Pastor Jason says, pasty white. She is pasty white, and she just arrived in Palau, which is near Guam. And the first day she was there, she went to the beach, she went snorkeling, and the next day she realized she was like fried. That's what she told me. She's like, I'm not just burned, I'm fried. She's like, I've never had a worse burn in my life, right? She's not used to being with that intensity. The sun's near the equator, right? So it's more intense. So you don't want to burn, right? That's not good for you, because then you increase your risk for melanoma especially, right? That's the bad one. So you want to get the blessings, but don't burn. And what we found is if you go out in short spurts, you will get the vitamin D, but not the burn. Like if you stay out for hours and hours on end, that's how you get the burn. If you go out and then come in and then go out and then come in, that's how you get the vitamin D, but not the burn. Also, they have found that this fiber is very much a direct linear effect with lowering of cholesterol. If you add 15 grams of fiber to your diet, you will predictably lower your cholesterol by 15%. What is that? That's a 45% reduction in your cardiac risk. Has anyone ever heard of the full plate diet? Anyone ever heard of that? The full plate diet is a very simple diet. There's only one rule. You need to eat 40 grams of fiber per day. And that's it. That's the only rule. Now, why do you suppose that would work not only for lowering your cholesterol, but also lowering your weight? How many calories per gram in fiber? Zero. Did you know that? It fills you up with no calories. It's the zero calorie wonder. Just like what beverage? Water, right? Zero calories. I want to move away now from the physical to the other parameters of our being, because we're not just physical beings. Did you know that? We are physical, mental, emotional, spiritual beings. There's other dimensions. And do these other dimensions affect our health? Absolutely. Did you know they have found that the type A personality has increased mortality from all causes, but especially from heart attack? And they tried to find out what was it in the type A personality. There is only two traits of the type A personality that increases your coronary death risk. It is not being on time. It is not being organized. It is not being a leader. It is not being ambitious. What do you guys think it is? It's not stress either. It is hostility and intolerance. It's okay if you're on time, but when you get angry at the person who's late, you know what happens? at that moment, not only does your blood pressure rise, your increased risk for fatal heart attack goes up 200%. And that risk lasts for 2 hours after the bout of anger. Sometimes it's not what you're eating, but what's eating you, right? It's not always what goes into your mouth, but what comes out of your mouth that matters, right? You know, I was talking with someone about stem cells earlier this week, and there are many times that even the most aggressive lifestyle treatment, even the most aggressive medical technology is not going to save your heart disease. There are some people that are so blocked off and so far gone that the only hope for them is a transplant, right? A new heart. And can you imagine getting an entirely new heart, a new set of coronary arteries, totally clean, totally unblocked? Getting a new set of cardiac muscle that pumps strong rather than having a bunch of dead tissue. When people have multiple heart attacks, when they have critical congestive heart failure, there is no lifestyle that will bring them back. There is no medical intervention that will bring them back. They are placed on a list. And you know what that list is called? The transplant list. And that is a very serious place to be. Because what is that person hoping and praying will become available for them? It is a new heart. But do you realize that in order for you to live, it means that someone else had to die? That's true spiritually as well. All of us need a new heart in the spiritual sense. But for in order for us to live, it meant Jesus Christ had to die. He told us that I will give you the heart transplant. And in Genesis, Abraham reveals an interesting insight. Where does that transplant come from? He says, my son, God will provide who? Himself, a lamb for the sacrifice. I pray that you have a renewed heart, not only physically, but spiritually. Thank you.
You have been listening to a special presentation sponsored by the Bay Roberts Seventh-day Adventist Church. It is our desire, as we share the good news of Jesus Christ with our community, to foster an environment that promotes a holistic approach to living, with appropriate attention to health of body, health of mind, and health of spirit for all. We seek to accomplish this service to our community by providing health, family, and personal spiritual enrichment programs. This congregation of Christian believers meets each Saturday morning for Bible study as well as for praise and worship. If you would like to know more about the Bay Roberts Seventh-day Adventist Church or to find out what other community events are ongoing or upcoming, please visit us on the web at www.bayrobertssda.org. Or if you'd prefer, feel free to write Bay Roberts Seventh-day Adventist Church, P.O. Box 930, Bay Roberts, Newfoundland, A0A1G0. Or reach us by telephone at 709-786-7516. May God richly bless you and yours.